Tonight's Dharma talk is entitled The Winds of Homecoming. And it comes from a Rilke poem that I love, which I'll read to you a little later. But first, a very short vignette that I'd like to share. A blind man was begging in a city park. Someone approached and asked him whether people were giving generously. The blind man shook a nearly empty tin. His visitor said to him, "Let me write something on your card." The blind man agreed. That evening, the visitor returned. "Well, how were things today?" The blind man showed him a tin full of money and asked, "What on earth did you write on that card?" "Oh," said the other, "I merely wrote, today is a spring day and I am blind." When I first read that, I was trying to sense, so what is it about that that moves me? And it's not that if we're blind, we can't see, or if we're deaf, we can't hear, as much as how many moments of our life, it's right here, the springtime, or the love, the mystery, the awareness, it's right here, but our habit of leaving has made us blind to what's here. And that if there's any real deep sadness in our life, and it's what I traditionally call a soul sadness, it's because we intuit the possibility of living fully, of really not holding back our loving. We intuit the possibility of presence, of really being alive here. And yet each of us knows how much of our time we're preoccupied, already occupied, not available for the spring, or whatever the season. But since it's spring and it's so wonderful, it's, you know, meaningful to use that language. So we know soul sadness. I had one friend whose daughter's a freshman in college, and she has found out her daughter's going to be spending the summer out west, and she's really grieving how in high school she was a dutiful mother. She showed up the way she should have, but in some way she didn't really appreciate the time together. They didn't play. They didn't live it together so much. She was kind of blind to, oh, this is it. And that's the way it always is. This is it. There's not something else. But if we have the idea that we're on our way to something else, we don't take this fully or seriously. And so, and then there's, I was at a retreat, and an older gentleman was describing one day at the retreat how it started raining, and he was sitting inside sipping his tea and really tasting it and really hearing the rain. And then he started weeping because he realized he had plowed through the decades achieving and doing and accomplishing and proving. And you all know what I'm saying, but not really hearing the rain or tasting the tea. So it's the soul sadness that it's springtime, but we're not, you know, and it's got a happy, sad piece because, you know, we suffer when we cut off from presence, when we habitually leave. And the whole spiritual path is this path of forgetting and remembering. And the good news is that awareness wants to realize itself through these body minds. There is a longing for presence. So there's a kind of happy, sad, because even when there's that soul sadness, there's also a sense of what's possible. We wouldn't have the soul sadness unless we sensed the love and the awareness that's here, the possibility. So this is the Rilke poem. Not to be cut off, not through the slightest partition, shut out from the law of the stars. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds and deep with the winds of homecoming. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds and deep with the winds of homecoming. So we'll explore tonight the winds of homecoming, how we get cut off, and really how the, whether it's the soul sadness that kind of wakes us up, that thing that says, I don't want to miss out on the spring, or whether it's sometimes winds that are more violent. Sometimes the pain of separation doesn't come as a soft kind of longing. The pain of separation comes as an angst or a loneliness or a huge fear or a sense that our lives are a despair, that our lives are wasted. The winds of homecoming are not always gentle, but they're a wake-up. Do you know what I mean? When we're suffering, it's a wake-up. It tells us in some way we're cut off from what we are. So to begin with, in the Buddhist teachings, and this is true for mystical traditions, the wisdom traditions, the getting cut off and the feeling cut off is a universal phenomena. It's not a mistake. We emerge, these forms emerge to perceive ourselves as separate. So there is a kind of fundamental conditioning to sense a self in here, me, and a world out there. And all organisms have that. And with that comes some vulnerability. If there's a self in a world, there's a sense of being endangered. And there is a sense of me that needs to then go around pursuing this agenda of protecting. We spend a lot of moments protecting. And so, rather with humans, this is all organisms do this, self, other, protect. But with humans, because of our thinking and our cognition and our societies and so on, the sense of separation reaches great new heights and great new depths of suffering. And so there's this more solid self sense. So that even as a young child, there's this like kind of genetic coding that tells us, you know, in addition to the culture's messages, this almost genetic coding that tells us we need to develop this self and we need it to be well protected and it needs to achieve and it needs to do this, this, and this to be successful. So we get very solidified as this separate self. And we adopt a set of strategies. And this is true for every one of us, that we've adopted a set of strategies to protect this sense of self and to try to become more safe, try to get more pleasure, less pain. And we see it as in a culture that it just pervades the culture. The self has to compete. There's a sense of endangerment and competing all the time. I love this little story, one-upmanship. Three stores are on a main street in town and they're side by side and they all sell the same kind of merchandise. So one day the owner of one store at one end puts up a sign, rock bottom prices. This prompted the storekeeper at the other side to hang up a sign, lowest prices in town. The owner of the store in the middle was thrown by these aggressive maneuvers until he came up with a bright idea. He put up his own sign which proclaimed, main entrance. I was away last week on a trip. I'm going to tell you more about it. But there was, every store had this thing. And one store would say 75% off everything here. And then you'd walk a little further, 80% off of everything here. And we decided we'd wait till they said 100% off and then walk in, main entrance. So with any sense of self, we develop these protective strategies. And it's our instrumentation to navigate through a challenging world. And this is what I call the false self, the set of strategies to prove ourselves, to protect ourselves, to look good, to cover up. It's also sometimes called a persona. And I learned recently that the the Greek word for persona means looking through. And it comes from the theater, Greek theater, where the players would hold up masks and they'd look through the mask, and the mask was the persona. And so what happens is this ego personality or this mask becomes our way of making it through. We want a mask that other people are going to like and approve of and respond well to and not reject, that's going to look powerful and handsome and beautiful and so on and so forth. And so from very early on, we start developing these masks. We all do this. And we paint our masks through our life, you know, and we shape them and we remodel them when we're adolescents so that we have masks that are different than our parents, right? And then we find out decades later we created the same mask, but back when we're adolescents, it doesn't seem that way. And there's nothing wrong with having a mask. In fact, I sometimes refer to this as our space suit for those that have been here regularly. We need to have some sort of a space suit or mask. We need a parent mask that has a way of giving our children riverbanks, you know. And we need our work mask that keeps us kind of disciplined and so on. But on the spiritual path, developmentally, we get arrested if our sense of who we are is fused with the mask. In other words, there's nothing wrong with developing an ego. In fact, there's no way to operate if we don't. But if our sense of beingness, if our deep sense of what we are, if consciousness gets fused with the mask, that's the forgetting. That's the getting cut off. So we come into existence, this ocean of existence, waves get created. If the ocean thinks it's a specific set of waves, they're suffering. They're suffering because there's an intuition of belonging, but there's in a daily way a kind of a forgetting of the vastness and the mystery. And each of us, to some degree, has these masks that we're looking through and operating through, and we forget. We forget that we are what is looking through the mask. We're the presence that's listening. We're the awareness that's experiencing right now. We're not the set of strategies or persona that's being presented. So the Buddha described suffering, our ignorance, ignoring the truth in this kind of simple way of forgetting what we are, hitching our sense of being to a small self, forgetting that boundlessness, that awareness. So it's an interesting inquiry to ask, well, who am I taking myself to be? Now, our persona, our mask, shift around in different situations. We basically have kind of a set of masks that kind of have a kind of common pattern to them. But you know how with one person who's very accepting and warm, you'll have one sense of yourself, and with somebody else that's judgmental, you'll have another. And in some settings, you'll have another sense of who the persona is. Same cluster of waves, but different flavors, right? So who are we taking ourselves to be? I mean, here at class, when you come on Wednesday nights, what's your sense of yourself? Do you have a kind of persona of I'm kind of a dabbler and I'm just kind of here checking things out? Or is there a sense of, well, I'm a dedicated meditator? Or is there a sense of outsider? Or is there a sense of I'm an insider and I want other people to feel like insiders? Or, you know, what's our persona? What's our sense of ourself when we've just made a mistake? Or somebody said something inconsiderate? Who do we become in those moments? Or who do we become when we're relating to our bodies? Or our gender? So what happens for most of us is we contract and we think we're something smaller And we forget that we are the awareness that's looking through the mask. We're the one that's experiencing. Now, part of what wakes us up is that the more stress we get into, the more rigid and inflexible the mask is, and the more suffering, and the more then we have to say, oh, I'm stuck. So most of us know how that goes, that sometimes our persona, oddly enough, gets most stuck. We have the strongest sense of a separate self, of a limited separate self with the beings that we really love or are closest to. Why is that? It brings up the most wanting and the most fearing. We're most invested. The more invested that we are, the more we contract. There's a saying, no matter how old a mother is, she watches her middle-aged children for signs of improvement. So back to me. I was away for a week on vacation, and I went away with some very dear friends and with my partner, Jonathan, and with my mother, who kept watching me to see if I was eating enough, you know, and with my 20-year-old son, Narayan, who I've spoken about here. And I got to really watch, because there were some stressful periods, watch this persona, this shrinking into a small self in living color. We traveled during that weekend when hundreds of thousands of people were stranded. You know the weekend I'm talking about? Where the weather and missed flights and so on made for a disaster zone for travelers. And so we ended up missing our flight and missing a whole day of the trip, like having to go back home from the airport and so on. And my son, who this is a vacation he had been excited about for like 8 months, and his girlfriend was already waiting for us down there. And so he was miserable. And I would have been fine, but watching my son get miserable, I completely contracted. And I contracted it. My basic persona is, if, you know, he's unhappy, then it's my fault, and then I'm unhappy. And in some way, it just tripped off bad mothering. You know, it's like, why didn't, if I cared about my mother and my son and everybody getting to this vacation, why didn't I get to the airport earlier? You know, it was that kind of thing. So I got into this very guilty place and really, really contracted. So I could watch my persona, and then when I could slow down and say, oh, okay, what's going on here, begin to find some space. And I'll talk about that in a bit, the homecoming when we get trapped. But the flags, and this is what I want to emphasize, the flags of when awareness has fused with this separate self, and when we're stuck, when we're cut off, one flag is we speed up. Some of us completely freeze. Some of us go to sleep, but most of us speed up. So I want to say that speeding up. Another flag is our minds start obsessing and fixating. If you find that you're speeding up and your mind is fixating, that means cut off, caught in separate self persona. We start trying to control things. And in the most basic way, we start judging. When we are cut off, the reflex is to blame something. We start blaming. We blame others. I blame my son for not being totally gracious and making me feel bad about myself, but mostly moi, you know. Mostly it was me. And our self-sense, the separate self-sense, really organizes around a sense of deficiency. So if you want to begin to explore this waking up from this trance of separate self, from the identification with persona, the flags, speeding up, a lot of mental activity that's fixating, trying to control things, and blaming. Blaming, blaming, and then blaming some more. There's a cartoon with this guy who's in heaven. God's kind of welcoming him to heaven and very benignly saying, no, 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 that's not a sin either. My goodness, you must have worried yourself to death, you know. So when our identity narrows and we get into the speeding up, bad self, bad other, the persona, it could be the guilty mother persona, or the hyper, driven workaholic persona, or it could be whatever the persona is, then we see through a lens that sees only other people's personas. We don't see who they are. If you're caught in a sense of small self, all you'll see is the kind of presentation of others. You might remember Mark Twain, who wrote, "When I was 14, my father in particular was such a fool, I was embarrassed to have him around. I marveled at 21 how in 7 years the old fellow had learned so much." So this is what I call unreal others. When we are cut off from the vastness within our own being, others become two-dimensional, and we get caught in stereotyping, and we can make war, and we can cause injury. Cutting off, when we're cut off, we then violate others. Some of you might remember the story I shared a couple of weeks ago about the family and the young boy and the homeless man, the bum that was, this woman just had a total stereotype of who he was. And then she had a kind of awakening. Why does that matter so much to us? Because each of us knows how much we walk through the world and categorize others and keep our hearts kind of closed off. So this winds of homecoming begins with feeling the angst about that. And the angst can be a kind of a subtle longing of, I really want to be here for this spring. I want to listen to the birds, and I want to smell the blossoms, and I want to love the person I'm with without holding back. We can feel it as a longing. Or it might come in a harsher way of really feeling this depression or angst. In a very basic way, we want to reconnect or come home to ourselves and then be able to be with others and see what's there, not get caught in the stereotypes. A month ago, I gave a talk at Mount Holyoke, and these women had organized a gathering to hear about Buddhism and so on. And I kind of was imagining the group of women that would be there. And in retrospect, it was a stereotypical imagination because they weren't anything like what I thought they'd be. But I want to just share with you that the talk I gave at Mount Holyoke at this proper Ivy League college was held in Hooker Auditorium in the Clap Building. Seriously. I just wanted to share that with you. I just thought that was really something. So the pathway, the homecoming, we feel this angst that in some way we're missing out. And we are missing out because we're preoccupied, we're caught in our stories, we're caught in our ambitions, we're caught in thinking that what we want is down the road. We're caught in our ideas about ourselves. We're caught in trying to have a better self. We're caught in thinking the self is bad. And we miss out on spring. This is Pema Chodron. She says, "Being preoccupied with our self-image or concept is like being deaf and blind. It's like standing in the middle of a vast field of wildflowers with a black hood over our heads. It's like coming upon a tree of singing birds while wearing earplugs." So let's explore the practices of waking up. When we're caught in this trance, this occupation with selfness. In other words, when we're believing our story, because it's not just identified with the mask we're presenting to the world, we're identified with the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. It's an inner mask. How do we wake up? So again, to say that the fuel that turbocharges the trance, the thing that keeps the trance going, that keeps us cut off, is speed, mental fixation and obsession, controlling, and blaming. So how do we wake up? How do we, in a way, stop fueling that selfing? Slow down. I guess you can guess this, right? I'm going to say all the opposites, right? Not exactly. I'll try to use more graceful language. But we begin by pausing. There is no way to cut through the conditioning of selfing without pausing. It just rolls on. It rolls on and on and on. This sense of a self going somewhere, having to do things, judging. Pause. The sacred art of pausing. So just try it right now. Just sense, what is it like? Just sense the radicalness of just stopping. To pause simply means make space for what's here. Arrive right here. There's nowhere to go. Nothing to do. So we begin to wake up by the space of a pause, the stillness, being the silence. And we deepen our attention with the wings of mindfulness. Can you notice in this pause what's happening? Just listening, not controlling. So the wing of noticing and the wing of heartfulness, of a caring, a kind of tenderness that allows what is here to be as it is. Heartfulness and mindfulness. There's a simplicity here. Henry David Thoreau says the soul grows or wakes up not by addition but by subtraction. That we stop. That we arrive home again, right here. Just noticing how it is with kindness. Now you can open your eyes and we're going to just investigate this a little more. So the situation we run into is we get lost and forget. We get cut off, right? We get into our obsessive thinking and doing and playing out our persona and thinking that's what we are. That's the situation. And then we're invited by all the spiritual traditions to slow down and pay attention. Right? And then what happens? Well, it's not always so pleasant. Have you noticed when you pause that sometimes there's a real clutch of anxiety, or restlessness, or physical unpleasantness? How many of you noticed that just now, that it's not always that way? Sometimes there can be huge space and freedom, but how many of you noticed when you paused it wasn't such a pleasant place to be here? How many? Yeah, some. How many of you paused and there was a kind of a relief, like, well, here, that's more real. How many of you noticed that? Just that, oh yeah, whew. Yeah. Now some of the hands that just went up could be for both. It can be not so pleasant, but there's a sense of gladness to be here, because I'd rather be here and awake than in some way occupied and running away. This is where we're going. So the arriving is to pause and to notice and to hold with kindness. But what we often encounter is the very clench of unease that we've been running from so fast. The angst, that core sense of a separate self that perceives things as not okay. That's what we run into. So really our practice is, how do we come to peace or freedom with that fundamental clench? Does that word clench make sense? How many of you, that's confusing language? Just as feedback to me, when I say quieting down and feeling a clench, how many find that confusing? Just help me out here. Some. So let me say more, because I feel like this is a really valuable place to inquire. This is really about, are we going to run away from the moment? Or are we going to arrive? And if we're going to arrive, how are we going to really make peace with what's here? Because what we encounter is that existential sense of something's wrong. I'm a separate self and I need to protect myself. Here's how Charlotte Joko Beck describes it. And she, Charlotte Joko Beck is a wonderful Zen teacher who's probably now about 88, West Coast. And her biggest inspiration of books was a book called The Supreme Doctrine by Herbert Benoit. He was a French psychiatrist who was in this severe accident that left him almost completely helpless for years. And during those years, all he could do was, in a sense, lie there. So since the human problem was his all-consuming interest, he spent all that time just investigating what is the nature of suffering and how do we free ourselves. So here's what he came up with. Charlotte writes this. She says, Benoit's term for the emotional contraction arising from our efforts to protect ourselves is spasm. He calls the ceaseless chatter of our inner dialogue the imaginary film. The turning point for him comes when he realizes that this spasm, this clutch, that he had thought was abnormal, actually is part of the path towards freedom. One can indeed say that what should be perceived under the imaginary film is a certain profound sensation of cramp, a paralyzing grip of a mobilizing cold, and that it is on this hard couch, immobile and cold, that our attention should remain fixed as though we tranquilly stretched out our body on a hard but friendly rock that was exactly molded to our form. So again, under the imaginary film is a certain profound sensation of a cramp, a paralyzing grip, and it's on this hard couch that our attention rests, that we tranquilly stretched out our body on a hard but friendly rock that was exactly molded to our form. So what Benoit is talking about is that instead of running away from the existential grip of feeling a kind of vulnerable self that's going to be in trouble, rather than we run away from that hard, edgy experience, we lie down in it. We lean in. We actually sit down into the very place that we've been running from. Hence the meditation instructions. We breathe with what's difficult. We open to it. We surrender our attention into it. We really fully be with what's here. Now, it doesn't mean we can always do it right away or that it's even wise. There are times when there's too much trauma or too much terror, and we need to develop more of a sense of balance or safety or support. So this instruction isn't to say that we always lie down on the icy couch, that we always open into the difficulty. But it's to say that eventually it's by staying, by opening, that we actually discover the space of freedom. It's by staying that we discover what we've been longing for, which is the love, the presence, the wakefulness that's our nature, only by staying. So we're in a catch-22, because the more we run away, the more we try to figure things out, the more we blame ourselves and others, all those flags I mentioned, that reinforces a sense of the persona. I am the self in trouble. I'm the victim myself. I'm the offending self. And it's the way we cut through, pause, notice what's here, and open to it. I'd like to say that it doesn't work, this leaning in or opening to what's difficult, unless there's a tremendous amount of kindness. So many times what I'll describe in here that works is if you're sitting and becoming present and something feels difficult, to offer loving kindness to it. You can even put your hand, right? I often put my hand on my heart, and it's like I'm offering company and care and presence in a very tender way to the place that's difficult. And the very act of offering tender presence gives it space to untangle, to free up. I want to read you Rilke again, a different one. In this he says, there is a boundary to looking, and the world that is looked at so deeply wants to flourish in love. For there is a boundary to looking, and the world that is looked at so deeply wants to flourish in love. Work of the eyes is done. Now go and do heart work on all the images imprisoned within you, for you overpowered them, but even now you don't know them. Learn, inner man, to look on your inner woman, the one attained from a thousand natures, the merely attained but not yet beloved form. So what does this mean, the merely attained but not yet beloved form? My understanding is that we can breathe with and be with and look at and investigate the knots and tangles of emotions in our body and heart. And that's helpful. But there's not a freedom unless we truly hold what's here. The jealousy, the fear, the anger, the hurt, with a profound quality of love. That's what liberates our hearts, is to love the painful places. So I'm going to go back to this trip where I was stuck. And I was stuck in my kind of contraction of I'm bad and you're bad with my son. And say that some years earlier I had begun to untangle that. That was a kind of a formation or a part of persona that I had looked at and investigated. And there was a kind of real opening, I think it was his junior year of high school, when we kind of reached one of those things where he was being irresponsible and making promises and not keeping them. And it got to the point that I was going around with a kind of a chronic irritation. Like even when he was doing nothing wrong at all, my mindset was, you're doing something wrong. And I was tensed again. There was an armoring in my heart. And so for me, the winds of homecoming came as sensing this armoring and sensing how much I didn't like my angry, irritated, controlling mother self. I just didn't like myself. And that was those were the winds of homecoming. Those were the kind of signs of cut off and separated for me. And so I did some meditating with it and really paused. And the imaginary film was basically saying, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. But really it's my fault because I didn't discipline you when you were younger. And I had this whole you're bad, I'm bad thing going, just as I did in the airport. And then slowed down even more and sensed what is really happening inside. And that's where I found the icy couch. I found this kind of hard fist clenching my heart. And if there was any belief around it, it was in some way that we didn't have love, that love wasn't there, that if he was behaving this way, he didn't really love me. I know that sounds kind of immature, but that's, in some way, I felt unloved. So that was the icy couch, and I had to kind of just absolutely rest my attention in it, like give in and just open to that clutch that in my heart. And I put my hand on my heart and breathed with it and cried with it and just felt it. And after some time, there was some sense of opening into being the awareness that was just tenderly holding my own heart. I was no longer the bad mother. I was no longer the hurt mother. I was the awareness. I was who was looking through the mask. I was who was listening to the cries of my own weeping. I was the awareness that was experiencing the pain. Do you see the shift in identity there? That as long as I was running from things in my mental obsession or my controlling behavior or judgment, I was avoiding that fist, that clutch of armored hurt. When I paused and I deepened attention and opened to it, in the opening I became that openness that was tender. And the selfing of the persona began to dissolve. This is how we begin to decondition this identification with a small self. Stop running. Pause. Stop pursuing the thoughts. Don't believe our thoughts. Arrive here, because here is the gateway to the awareness and the presence that we're longing for. So just to say, that kind of process of pausing and being with that clutch isn't a one-shot. And so but the good news is when this happened in the airport, because I had gone through rounds like that, it was much quicker for me to see the controlling hurt mother persona and get in touch with, oh, unlove. This is about unlove, feeling unloved, and then get tender more quickly. There was less lag time, less moments that I was cut off from the springtime, so to speak. That's my sense of really our practice and what it offers, is that we are in the habit of being cut off, being preoccupied, and in that trance where we race through our day and don't necessarily connect so much with our own hearts and with each other. And that in time we're really training ourselves to come back here. And the flags, we each have different ones. For some, the flag is an acute stab of loneliness. And for others, the flag is a sense of an intolerable self-aversion that we've been living with and we realize it. And for others, it might be anxiety, or in others, it might be this longing to really know who we are and be free. And if we pause and listen, those winds will carry us home. If we pause and really be here, that here-ness will reconnect us with what we're longing for. So let me just do a little practice with this so that you get to kind of try it out. And to say there's nothing new in these practices that I'm describing tonight, maybe a little different language, but it really is the pathway to freeing and healing. So this little reflection we'll do now, it'll be very short. It's just for you to try it on some. Sense this as a pause. And just honor a kind of arriving. Notice what you're arriving into. what the here-ness is like. And just feel a willingness, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. A valuing of what's real. You might sense if there's anywhere right now in your life where you're really aware of getting stuck or identified in your persona in a reactive way. Places where it's more stressful, more fear and wanting. So whether it's something like me with my son or at work with a partner, just where you get caught so that you're kind of acting out of fear, guilt, shame, hurt. Where you get small and forget the vastness, where you're cut off. And just to experiment and let that situation be close up and real for you right now. Sense what it's like. What's the experience of getting caught in that small self-reactivity? Sense what's really bothering you in that situation. What you're afraid of or not liking. Sense what you're believing. What's going to go wrong? Sense how you're behaving in that situation and what it feels like on the inside. The muscles of your body, the expression of your face, the feeling of your heart. You can exaggerate it a little so you really get a sense of what's this small self persona experience like. And really create some space for it so you can feel what most wants your attention in this. Feeling into the heart, the throat, the chest, the belly. What are you most running away from? I'm just sensing the courage to stay right now and just feel what's here. If it helps, putting your hand on your own heart and just really offering presence to the vulnerability that you've been running from. A very sincere, tender presence to what's here. Just breathe with it. Sometimes just sending the message, I care about this suffering. Or as one healer described it, I'm sorry, I love you. Just sorry for the suffering and offering care to the experience. Just as you would hold a fearful child, just to hold this life. Let it be a beloved form. And sense the one who's holding, the one that's present. Just sense your being as presence, caring presence. relaxing the attention, open to just now whatever arises in your senses, just listening, feeling the life in this body. Feeling that openness of awareness, the field of consciousness that includes all the waves. Not to be cut off, not through the slightest partition shut out from the law of the stars. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds and deep with the winds of homecoming. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.